Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's October 24th, 2021, and welcome to episode 244 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
Here's the Air is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and many things that contain... Why did I think that? For some reason, I thought there were a lot of 24s. Oh, it's 24. That's where it's October 24th, and it's episode 244. That's where all the 24s came
from.
Oh,
look at that!
Yeah,
look at those twos and those fours.
That's right. That's great. I have a
that was seamless, Paul. Seamless.
Thanks. Yeah, my phone for years now has had the you know, like when it rings, it makes the sort of canonical office ringtone from the show 24. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so
that's an odd choice.
Yeah, because I mean, like,
I can hear it.
Yeah, if you watch the show, it's sort of like it's ever present. It's an interesting sound.
Yeah, when they're in CTU, phones are always ringing.
Yeah, and it's just a standard office sound, but it's still anyway.
I've made the mistake on occasion of changing my ringtone to a bit of a song that I like, but then if that song ever plays, it triggers me like I should be answering the phone. So that's not a thing I do anymore.
Yeah. Though it is actually kind of nice to have something that's not default, because otherwise on television programs and everything, you're thinking, oh, I have a message, you know, oh, my phone's ringing because they do that.
Or it's an excuse to not have to pick up your phone. Oh, I thought it was somebody else.
Yeah. I thought it was on TV.
My phone sounds like everybody's. So that's why I never answer when you call. It's not because I got call display.
Right. I was wondering, actually, this came up when I was in some other conversation somewhere else, but is it possible to get a busy signal anymore? Do the kids of today know what a busy signal is?
Or what it means to be lost?
I called a business the other day, and I got a busy signal.
What'd you call it?
I was like, what? What is that, and how dare you?
Yeah, normally it's just voicemail.
Right.
What bugs me, I cannot believe we went from you get a message and you get a beep, nice and simple, 30 years ago, to now you get a message, then you get a long recorded spiel from the telephone company saying, at the sound of the tone, you could do this or press. I'm like, is it that young people don't know what to do if they hear a beep? Like, did we lose the training on that? Crazy that that's not an option anymore.
All right. And with that,
old man shakes fist at phone.
Well, I remember the show Miami Vice. Mm-hmm. Crockett had a great outgoing message. He was like, it's the 80s. You know what to do.
And then there would be nowadays a long explanation of what to do.
Right.
And Tom right, keeps leaving messages like, no, it doesn't work anymore. Crockett's like, I'm too cool to roll down my sleeves or change my message.
I think this came up in the context of... I was explaining, I think, what a black box was, you know. So that's the way that's supposed to work is essentially it holds the voltage of the phone, and so it's such a point where you actually answer it and it does make the audio connection, but the phone company doesn't think you've answered it yet, so they don't start billing.
Sneaky.
Yeah. All these things that are, you know, hopelessly obsolete now.
Yep.
All right. So the topic today.
Speaking of hopelessly obsolete.
That's right. Yeah. So
welcome to the show.
We talked, I guess it was a couple times ago. I don't know. One time ago, I think, about this cart, this board basically made for the TI-99/4A called the Strange Cart that is something that Eric Peel put together. And I think we expressed a little bit of confusion about exactly, or like, you know, there's questions about sort of like, to what extent is this sort of cheating, you know, when you've got you're sort of attaching like a much powerful computer to the computer to do all the work. What specifically this was, for people who don't remember from the last episode, is it was basically a re-implementation of BASIC with a TI BASIC in a FPGA that ran much, much, much faster. So essentially, you put in the cart and you do some sort of things with saving and loading the program to sort of get it to you know, have the program in the cart, and then it runs. And it's, you know, whatever, it's running much faster, but at the same time, it isn't actually running TI BASIC. It's running something that's binary compatible. And so Eric wrote on our Facebook page about this a little bit, and was sort of, I don't know, clarifying a little bit what the goals were, you know. So the question he asked, and the question that I think is at least in the area of what we wanted to address, is kind of like, what is the motivation to create these modern contraptions for retro computers? Like, why do people do this? And so what Eric said is that, yeah, I'm driven by curiosity and the desire to learn new skills. Building something like the Strange Cart requires decent skills in computer architecture, electronics design, PCB design, surface mount component assembly, which I do by hand, TMS 9900 assembly programming, TI GPL programming to know how in order to re-implement TI BASIC, and all these things. You know, many of these skills are non-trivial. Some are professions in their own right, and all have created those enjoyable moments, having a sense of accomplishment, such as getting the LED to flash the right way the first time, and so forth. You know, so I think that is also an interesting kind of attack on this. That it's kind of what you're doing is you're learning how to make PCBs, you're learning how to do electronic engineering, but in the context of an old computer project that you want to try to do. So it is, you know, it's not necessarily that the motivation is I want my TI to do something faster. You know, it's I want to learn how to do this. I want to be enough of a Renaissance person to do this. So I thought that was interesting, and I thought it sort of made for a possibly interesting topic to talk about. And it may not be exactly what we all thought the topic was going to be, but the way I had written it down in the show notes was sort of like talking about times you've spent learning how to do something that has sort of no future relevance, and that may not exactly describe what I just read, but in that neighborhood, you know, what are our motivations for doing things like this, particularly with maybe like newer tech applied to older tech? Earl, I think you said you had a response to something more like what I just read from the show notes.
I was thinking about it. There are three things that came to the top of my mind. Two are in the past and one's in the future. So
Nothing right now.
Yeah, nothing right now. Well, one of them is kind of right now. But so for our next Without Four podcast, and I'll talk a little bit more about this maybe when we get to the closing section. But Randy Kindig and I relearned the language Snowball from the 60s. That has no future relevance for me whatsoever. Why did I do it? Well, that's explained in the episode, and I won't do a spoiler. Yeah, exactly. It's a shameless plug. But I think probably the main motivation was I remembered it from university. And it was like just a tickle in my brain. Like, I remember that kind of, and I remember it was really fun, but I don't remember that much about it. So let me do a super deep dive and see what it was all about. And again, I don't think that will ever help me in the future unless I go to a party and somebody just happens to bring up, hey, did you ever program in Snowball? So, you know, I mean, that could happen, but, it was a very interesting thing to learn about, and I don't regret that at all. But now there is one that I kind of do regret a little bit. I try not to regret the time that I spend with retro, because it's always fun learning things, just even if you're not going to leverage them in the future. It's just kind of learning for learning's sake, right? But I tried to also do a deep dive into FPGAs. And I got a mid-range in the $200-ish dollar realm FPGA board, and tried to learn how they work. And I found out that even though there are a few people who are trying to make this approachable for hobbyists, it's still really not that easy to learn about. I mean, it's easy to learn trivial skills like blinking an LED, but if you want to do something complicated, like a project that involves a virtual CPU and some virtual RAM and input and output, you get into digital design challenges that you almost have to be a double E to understand. Mm-hmm. Timing constraints and how the FPGA tools translate what you're trying to tell it to do into the actual placement that it puts into the fabric of the FPGA is just, it was mind-blowing. And I was thinking there's got to be courses or books or something that I could read on this outside of going back to school and getting an electrical engineering degree, which I didn't want to do and didn't have time to do. And it was just hard. And it was hard enough, actually, that I put it aside and I haven't really revisited it. And my motivation was I saw that a lot of people were using FPGAs to build projects for retro computers, to either simulate things that the retro computers did, like the Mister, or to handle things that required such complex timing that it was difficult to do with something like an Arduino or another maker-friendly thing. I wanted to learn about that stuff, but it was just too hard. I may come back to it, but for now, it's just some things that I learned that are stuck in the back of my brain and aren't really getting any traction. Mm-hmm. The thing that's the now or future thing is hooking up an Altair to a modern RGB LED matrix and having the Altair control it so it could do patterns or do little scrolls of words, things like that. Fun? Useful? I don't know. Mm-hmm. The particular interface board that I'm using, I don't know how many people have this particular interface board. It seems like maybe it's kind of rare. Back in the day, people used this parallel interface board to hook their Altair to things like a hard drive. But will anybody look at this and go, oh, yeah, that looks fun. I'll drag out my 88.4 PIO board and do that. I don't know. And, you know, how much will I play with it after I actually make it work? It's kind of one of those like climbing the mountain because it's there mm-hmm. sort of things. Just I feel like I'm going to learn some things and I already have in the process. And then it'll be like, ooh, look at that. And then on to the next thing. In terms of the motivation for why to do this stuff, gosh, we could have a whole episode. We could talk for hours on the motivation of doing retro things. Why do we play with these old computers at all? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think they're really cool and they're really fun, but it's hard to articulate why that is.
Yeah, I guess that's true that, you know, when we're talking about sort of future usefulness, I'd been thinking about stuff like, you know, learning languages, like as you were saying, like Snowball or doing something like that, where it's not going to be sort of modern relevance, but it could be something that you would use in the retro computers. But I guess it's the same question of like, well, why is it actually relevant to make TIA Basic go fast? You know, I mean, I certainly have I've thought a little bit about, you know, going into, you know, learning how to do that same kind of like learn how to design 3D printed objects and learn how to design, you know, PCB layouts to make little like simple cards. And the idea, at least my thinking was that this is basically like this is a platform that I could, you know, sort of do something useful with a simple with a low level of knowledge, you know, because I understand that there are, you know, this actually it's not just easy. And it never was. So, but it's still kind of fun to be able to do like at least, you know, low level projects of this sort.
I wonder if you hit on something there when you said the TI Basic thing, because for TI-99/4 fans, it probably was a long standing frustration for them mm-hmm. that the Basic was so incredibly slow. And so even if it takes a modern take on it, going back and speeding that up might scratch an itch that somebody's had since back in the day. Another thing, a little later in the news, we'll talk about a talk on the 1541 drive. Mm-hmm. But apparently in 2013, if I'm remembering right, there was finally somebody discovered an algorithm that permitted them to really stream the bits fast mm-hmm. between the drive and the Commodore 64. And that's cool because if you were a Commodore 64 user back in the day, you're probably still waiting for your program to load. So being able to speed this up and make it like super fast That probably, again, scratches an itch that it's like, wow, this thing was so slow. And, oh, by the way, this algorithm that I'm talking about is without modified hardware. So it just took them 30-some years to figure this out, but they finally figured it out, and that would actually be kind of cool.
Yeah.
Because you would think, hey, I could have done this back in the day if we'd figured out how to do it, but now that we've got so much information and all these internets.
Yeah. Yeah, and it, I mean, I guess it does sort of breathe a bit of new life into the machine. You know, like there's now new stuff you could do that you couldn't do before because this thing hadn't been written, not because the machine was not available, but because it hadn't been figured out. That's a lot of what I often think about with the Apple III too. You know, like it's just, you know, everybody sort of moved on from it before they'd actually explored all the stuff it could do. So there's still new stuff to discover. Mm. Yeah. This also sort of reminded me of someone making a comment of about how pretty much every programmer has written a text editor. And it might actually be sort of something like that. Like, you know, we didn't need another text editor, but it's the kind of thing that you can write. And it's kind of, there's some pride in being able to make the thing work. And so, you know, so, and you know, I of course have several text. I have a nice 6502, you know, machine language text editor that ran quickly on the Apple II, had a way to handle upper and lowercase. And, you know, I didn't need to write that, but I could, and it worked and I used it.
Cool.
But it might be like, you know, that's why there are many different video output devices for these computers and why there are many different flash drive, you know, devices, because there are some that exist, but, you know, it's kind of fun to make them. I don't know. What do you think, Carrington? Do you have you any sunk time into obsolete pursuits?
I have. When I thought about the topic, I was thinking about, like, what have I sunk time into that's obsolete in the sense that it is not productive. It's going to go nowhere. Like, the world isn't affected by the fact that I know this. Probably I'm not affected by the fact that I know this. So I thought of most of my hobbies are that. Like, I like dancing. So I've taken and taught ballroom dance lessons. Like, it's just, how does that happen? Like, weirdest thing. When it comes to retro computing stuff, I'm kind of on the, my thinking went along the same line as Earl's, in that I thought of languages. Most recently, it's been a deep dive into ZIL, or ZIL, mm-hmm. the language that Infocom used to create their text adventures. And it's not a language, though, I intend to use for anything. I'm really enjoying making a text adventure now, which I'm doing in Punian form, which is a completely different language. Nothing to do with ZIL. Mm-hmm. The ZIL thing came from when there was a bunch of the source code for Infocom's programs, their games, got released, I think back in like 2019, something like that. I'm sure we talked about it. And so I got to see for the very first time some source code dumps from, say, Zork 1, something like that. And I remember just looking at it and how strange it looked. I don't know MDL, which was kind of based on, I didn't know any language that looked like that at all. And mostly I was struck by, like, when I first looked at the code, I remember thinking, the parentheses aren't closed. There's more open parentheses than closed parentheses. Is this a mistake? Like, did I immediately spot an error and I'm that good? Or is it like I don't understand it? Like, how is a language done that? No, it turns out I must have just misread it, because that's not a feature of the language. But I remember distinctly looking at the code going, there are five open and three closes, and what's going on? And it just, it struck me as so weird. I had to go learn the language. So I've spent a ton of time reading that Steve Moretzky manual. What was it? Everything You Always Want to Know About Writing Interactive Fiction But Couldn't Find Anyone Still Working Here to Ask, that he wrote back in 1989 about how to use this language. And then that got, like, dumped later. Like, I'm reading it from a PDF that got put out in the early 2000s or something. So I went through that a few times. There's a bunch of sources online now, and some discussion areas. There's a thing on Facebook where people discuss the language and writing code in that language and what they're doing with it. But I don't like Facebook, so I'm left out of that completely. So it's just me and a couple of PDFs learning a language that I don't intend to write anything in, which has been a very unusual experience, because typically the way I've always taught myself a language is I give myself a project and it'll end up terrible because I don't know the language, but I will just, like, dive through and say, okay, why don't I make this out of it? And I just figure out the language as I go. And by just cobbling it together, when I get to the end of that thing, and I have technically a working, if very inefficient program, I now go, okay, I know the basics of the language, and then I'll go back and get better at it and reiterate. Whereas I've learned this by just reading about it and then writing some stuff to make sure that I understand it, with no intention of ever writing a program in it. So it's the weirdest, most useless pursuit. But I like the game so much, it's kind of fun to read the language that they were made in. And I don't think I would do it if it wasn't for that. So it's the fact that it's another way to connect with these games that I love and have loved for decades. I think that's why I'm reading about this language. But it is the most useless of sunk time in my retro computing life, like by far, because I have zero intention of ever doing anything with it. And yet I keep trying it.
Yeah. But you do enjoy it. So, I mean, like,
I do.
There is that.
Otherwise, I wouldn't do it. Everything with retro computing is a hobby for me. And like most things in my life, I'm either loving it or it's gone. I have this rule that I'll stop saying I'm doing something when I spend more than X amount of time not doing it, depending on what it is. So I can't, for instance, say I'm writing a novel if it's been more than 90 days that I've worked on the novel. Then I'm no longer writing. And I used to have a ton of things that I was quote-unquote working on, but that I would take massive pauses from and never get back to. And it became almost overwhelming. Like, I had so many things I was supposedly doing, and yet I would sit around doing none of them because I was so overwhelmed by how many things I was working on. So it kind of gives myself permission to say, I'm no longer doing that. And that's fine. Maybe I will start doing that again. But when I consider things that I'm currently doing, it's only stuff I have touched in the last 30 days or so. And otherwise, it's no longer a thing I say that I'm doing. And that's helped. This is a language I'm still working on because it seems every month I read about it for no reason whatsoever. And it's really, I only have one book about it. So it's more that I keep going back and reading the same PDF printout over and over and then testing myself on it. It's how I spend my time.
I wonder if it's turned into a religion.
It may eventually. When you worship me, you will worship me in either MDL or SIL.
Yeah, nice.
I accept no other prayers.
Yeah, actually, one thing that... that I came across, let's see, I think I actually am already sort of sharing my screen. Yeah. That reminded me of this is in a sense, this is kind of, it's sunk time in a sort of like a normal nerd way in a way, but, Foon Turing, just posted a thread of things that was sort of interesting. It was basically going over, Twitter's changed something about how they handle, or at least they say they have changed something about how they handle images and basically under what conditions things will get converted into a JPEG based on the original image. So he did a bunch of tests, like he posted things of various resolutions and colors and sizes, trying to figure out, all right, well, so PNG images that are under a certain size will stay PNG and others will be converted to JPEG depending on various things. And he goes through just a big, long list of tests, like trying to figure out exactly what the limits are. You know, what it'll take to post something that will not get converted to JPEG. Eventually we get to the end of the thread.
Very long thread.
Yeah. Where does this thread end? I don't know. The thread ends here.
This is the thread that never ends.
Anyway, the good news is that these changes will not stop me from posting the entirety of Doom 1 shareware. And then he posts like a, you know, 3-ping image that has all the data from Doom 1 shareware, uncorrupted, not changed into a JPEG. So I thought that was a very good sort of example of...
I relate to that, though. I mean, like a lot of people who self-identify as nerds or geeks or whatever, I will get obsessed about a small thing and just like deep dive into it and then come up 18 hours later and go like... Oh, well, that was an interesting way to spend a weekend. I do that all the time, where I will just get obsessed with some small thing and just iterate on it like crazy for no reason.
Yeah. It's funny to see those projects, though. The only reason that we care about this is the ability to post the data, you know, properly on Twitter for something that, you know, you can't run on Twitter. But all right. Yeah, I don't think I had anything.
You've never wasted any of your time ever. All you do is efficient and useful. You robot.
Oh yeah. No, have I not answered the question? Maybe I haven't.
Yeah. Like, what do you do? What have you sunk your time into that was useless?
Yeah,
I mean, it's a safe space, Paul. Share.
I certainly have plans for such things. But I mean, like, you know, the kinds of things I've been doing is largely, you know, like trying to get Apple Talk networks to run, you know, and that kind of thing, where it's sort of like, it's more or less useless. I'm just allowing transmission of data from one machine over here to another machine over here. They will never see the outside world.
You also recently put an obscene amount of RAM into an SE30.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah, I guess that is sort of pointless.
it's absolutely pointless.
Yeah, that was an interesting exercise. It had 5 megabytes of RAM in it, and the way this SE30 is organized, it has 8 slots for RAM things. And so, and they have to be put in groups of 4 that match. So what that meant is there were like 4 of them were 1 megabyte SIMs, and then the other 4 were whatever a quarter of a megabyte is, 256, right? So it had 5. And I ordered, I got SIMs that would, the 8 megabyte SIMs, so that the whole thing could go up to 128 megabytes. I don't think there's anything that an SE30 can do with 128 megabytes. I mean, like, it was operating fine with 5. But I put them all in. Turns out and all the 8 megabyte SIMs are actually sort of tall, taller physically than I was anticipating. So when I put the thing back together, it wound up breaking the sort of supports for the last SIM, which means that I had to lose the whole end of that whole 4 bank. And then I couldn't...
Did you have to, or did you solve it creatively?
Well, eventually I did.
I saw the photo.
Yeah. The first attempt at this was a memory upgrade from my 5 megabyte SE30 to 4 megabytes because I had ruined one of the banks. But then I did manage to get it to work by using a bunch of rubber bands to hold the thing into place. So inside my SE30, there are three rubber bands holding it, so one can fail without it being catastrophic.
But it looks like police caution tape around your SIMs.
Yeah,
it's a hilarious thing with the one on the end leaning forward.
Yeah.
It's great.
But anyway, yeah, so now I do now have a 128 megabyte SE30 with a, you know, like several gigabyte hard drive on
Very
flash
useful.
Memory. And, you know, it's for shuffle puck, right, basically.
Man, I wish I had that back in the day. If nothing else, just for bragging rights.
Yeah,
to brag that you spent $5 million in RAM.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right.
Tell my friend, hey, how much memory does your SE30 have?
All of it. My spreadsheets go on for miles.
When I crash,
Isn't there
I crash
something
forever.
About the SE30 would they have 32-bit dirty ROMs or what am I remembering that you have to do something to get more than that amount of RAM in it?
Yeah, there's a the ROMs only they I think they only had normally 24-bit addressing. So I've also replaced the ROM.
Ah.
So it has a ROM disk in it. This is from Big Mess of Wires. They have something called the Rominator 2. And so it's got a ROM disk built in, and it's got it's fixed the 32-bit addressing, so it can actually access all that memory. And
excellent.
Yeah. It's
I don't think it
an SE30 in name only. But so I guess there's a pointlessness to that, I suppose. But
well, it's fun because it's like one of most people will agree it's one of the great Macs, the vintage Macs. Whenever you have a list of the 10 greatest Macs, it's always on there. People either have it or covet it. It's one of the, like, the most desirable things. It's the perfect Mac. And you looked at it and said, that's not good enough. That's not good enough for me. What everybody else loves is not good enough for Paul.
Right.
Paul will make it better.
Yeah, in a way that
I like
is
that. I applaud
not
that.
Detectable, really, except by looking at the about box. Anyway, yeah, I mean, the numbers barely fit on the, you know, like on the in the window of like how many megabytes are left, or how many K actually, I guess it's measured in. But
it'd be interesting to hear what Blake says about this, because I suspect he's got some very interesting things, because he's done a lot with networking and getting old systems to use in certain ways. So yeah,
he looks like the kind of person who have sunk a lot of time.
So it'll be interesting if he's on next time. I'm very interested to hear his response to this question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
You'll have to tune in next time for that.
Okay, so, and actually, I think we've mined all of the listener feedback for news items. So thank
well,
you, everybody.
Listeners can write us in to tell us what they have done that is useless.
Yeah,
share.
Sure. That would
share
be interesting.
Space.
No, I think that would be interesting. Yeah, so Jeremy in the chat says, I have a 2 gigabyte compact flash card in my Apple One replica.
Of course you do.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
mine has 64 megabytes.
The total of all Apple software is probably less than a megabyte.
Yeah,
it's got Apple One. Yep, you can have 2 of everything, which we call a Paul.
Yeah, yeah. It's I built a replica one, which is the the Vince Briel Apple One alike, you know, that's basically, it's got a real 6502 on it, but then a lot of the video and keyboard stuff is handled by some kind of, I think, Atmel chip. But anyway, I've got that set up, and it has the flash card CFFA 1 in it as well, too. It's pretty nice. But, I mean, seriously, I turned it on. I played Lunar Lander. I crashed, and that's probably it for this year of usage of that. But it still looks nice. And I built it, and it still works, so that's also good.
Exactly.
Okay, but we can maybe move on to items of interest in news. And Carrington, you have the first of these.
I do. Oh, yes, I'm sharing a window. So, really, so this is an article about a remote developer, one of perhaps the first remote developers, a fellow named Paul Lutus. This is a competing podcast, so you have my permission to go listen to that, then erase all record of it and come back to the RCR and listen to nothing else other.
Do it in a private window.
Exactly. Exactly. It's from Co-Recursive, which is actually a really good, really good thing. So this is episode 69, and it caught my ear because Paul Lutus is the fellow who wrote Apple Writer, and he wrote it living in a cabin on $40 a month. He worked at NASA, and the nice thing about Co-Recursive is they give you an entire transcript of the entire show. It is so professional. It's like, when you go listen to that, please do come back to our episodes, even when you hear what other people do that is so much better than we do. But he worked at NASA. In fact, there's a write-up in the Wall Street Journal. Switch over to that. Mountain Hermit makes Apple sing in simple English. So he worked at NASA and got sick of the rat race, got sick of the NASA pressure, dropped everything, got rid of it all, and went to move into the mountains in a tiny cabin. And while there, wrote software for Apple, wrote Apple Writer and some other things, and then started making $3 million a year in Apple Writer revenue, like the royalties, and just was like, oh, that changes everything, and had a better mountain cabin. But it's a really interesting story about, well, one, remote development and remote work, which is something that's come up the last couple of years for obvious reasons. And I just think it's delightful that I didn't really know this. I didn't know, here we have Mountain Hermit loves apples and teaches them basics. So in the 80s, he's referred to as a mountain hermit and as part of the whole spiel. And that is where we got Apple Writer from. Mm-hmm. This guy living in a cabin and just making it for himself. And then Apple putting it out and him making millions and millions of dollars. And that was $3 million in 1983 dollars. So it's like it's all of the money now. Yeah. He would have had all of the money. And now he basically sails around the world solo on boats. Like, he's still doing that hermit thing, but no longer for some reason making Apple II software. I don't know what's up with that. Maybe he'll come back to it. So it's really interesting. So we'll have a link to the Wall Street Journal, but I got that in the show notes. But the main thing is a link to the Co-Recursive podcast episode, episode 69, the original remote developer. Really good deep dive interview, really well produced. And if you like the show, you might find other things in it. Like this podcast is about development, about software development. So if you're interested in programming, it's a good podcast in general. But this was a particularly interesting episode for fans of old Apple II software.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one thing that Paul Lutus did also, this is actually unreadably small here. He also wrote Electric Duet, which was really actually kind of an interesting achievement, because it was allowing for the possibility of playing like two simultaneous notes on an Apple II speaker, which is the way the Apple II speaker works is basically you touch it and it clicks, and that is the entire control. And you know, if you click it fast enough, it will make a single tone.
But you Atari people can just put away your keyboards. We don't want to hear your feedback.
But this was actually really quite an accomplishment, figuring out how to make multiple notes play at the same time. Apparently he was also responsible for Music Comp, which was marketed by Apple, and which I think I have a copy of behind me somewhere. But anyway, it was an interesting engineering challenge, essentially, to figure out like how do you click the speaker at the right times in order to get two different sort of notes to come out. So that's the other thing I know of Paul Lutus for.
These are the things you can do when you live in a tiny mountain cabin surrounded by deer.
Right.
Got nothing else to do. Might as well write earth-changing Apple II software.
though I suppose it's possible that working on the music software caused the population of deer to reduce in the area. It's like, this cabin is not fun to be near. Okay. Excellent. Earl, you have the next thing. You teased it already earlier.
Oh, yes. So Tony wrote in to let us know about that, and a few other folks had tapped me on the shoulder about it too. There was a talk, I think it was at the VCF West, the ultimate Commodore 1541 disk drive talk. I don't remember the exact title, but that kind of sums it up. Mm-hmm. And it really is. It goes for 51 minutes and 30 seconds, I think. And it is the most information-dense 51 minutes that you'll spend in your life. It starts off talking about the physical nature of the drive, how floppies work, specifically how Commodore floppies work, and then goes from there into a lot more technical detail on specifically how a Commodore floppy is laid out in tracks and sectors, how they have different sector densities per track. It talks about the communication protocols that are used between the computer and the various devices on the serial bus, which includes the disk drives, but isn't limited to them. You'd have printers on there too. He talks about copy protection, what types were used, and what types of techniques can be used to recover the information that is on disks that have been thus copy protected. It's a very interesting talk. And if you're interested at all about that topic, either Commodore drives specifically, or just how a drive subsystem might have worked more generally, then I would very much recommend it. I watched the whole thing, and like I say, you got to keep up, because there's not a lot of fluff in this talk, but the bits and bytes are definitely there for folks who care. It's really interesting because, like some of the other 8-bit systems, the Commodore disk drives were a computer in their own right. They had a CPU, they had RAM, they had ROM, they had I.O. chips, and of course, all of this to interface with the electronics and the physical drive mechanism. It's kind of a complex device, and you can really drill into it, and this talk really does. So I very much liked it. Like I say, we'll have a link both to the Hackaday article and to the a direct link to the YouTube for this particular presentation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't watched it all yet, but I have seen enough of it to appreciate the density. It's really it's very well packaged, and in fact, actually, so this is Michael Steele, and this is the person who's behind PageTable.com. So we've talked about PageTable.com before, and this is as impressive as the written blog, but in talk form.
And it's not just, I agree with everything you just said, and it's not just the material that's presented, it's the graphics and the slides that he used as he goes through it, really well laid out, and in some cases with animations that drive the point home. I just loved everything about this.
Yeah. It's a very well spent 51 minutes or whatever. Okay, I guess I have the next thing. Oh, well, actually, maybe I'll just, since the next thing that came up was actually a different talk by Mike Steele on the Apollo guidance computer. So he's done a sort of a similar thing going deep into that. So if you liked the 1541 talk, you might also like this.
I haven't looked at that. Have you looked at that?
No, only to you know, find that it exists. So I haven't looked at that.
I'd be very interested to see it.
So my item of interest was sent in by listener Bob, and it is the 100 megahertz 6502. And so, you know, we've talked a little bit about doing FPGA projects, and you know, people have put together sort of CPU cores for that would do this 6502 or other things. And so the idea here is essentially using one of those 6502 CPU cores for an FPGA and putting it in place of a 6502. So in fact, rather than just like sort of making a mister or whatever you're doing with it, you instead just like put it back in your Apple II or your Commodore or PET or whatever, except that it can run much, much faster. So 100 megahertz as opposed to the one that it generally would run at.
That would have messed up your podcast, Carrington.
I think so.
Yes, definitely. Would have ruined everything.
The idea is to be a universal accelerator of a kind. And it's been tested out on a number of actual computers. So it works on the Apple II. It works on the Commodore. And I mean, so the way it works, I'm not quite exactly sure, you know, how well it works and what it does exactly. But I mean, essentially what it does at the outset is it loads in some kind of memory map so that it knows like where dangerous areas are. So at least on the Apple II, and I think probably other ones, there are IO spaces where, you know, you can't sort of disturb the stuff that's in them because they're going to change the screen resolution or mode or whatever, make the speaker click, that kind of thing. And so what it does is basically when it starts up, it takes a snapshot of everything except those places that it can't touch. And then basically from then on just operates internally to itself. So it'll touch the soft switches when it needs to do that, but otherwise it you know sort of uses its own RAM, but it's another one of those things where it is certainly an interesting project, an interesting challenge to see if you can do it. And you know, given that we have made these, I say we in the very broad sense, have made these 6502 cores for FPGAs, you know, an obvious thing to try would be to actually put it in place of an actual 6502. So anyway, it's kind of a neat idea. You know, it's basically just a FPGA on the right form factor chip.
And the core that it uses is called the Arlet core, used in some other projects. And it is the 6502 core that I played around with when I was doing the FPGA stuff that I was talking about earlier. One of the things that I was able to do with that Arlet core was actually get a system on a chip 6502 virtual thing operating and ran some sample code. So that core is pretty well understood, and it's actually fairly simple in design. So this is really interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of a funny idea. Though, I mean, I think, you know, the idea of accelerating these computers is, you know, that's always on people's minds because they are really kind of slow. And it's at least I know with, you know, I'm more familiar with what you have to do in the Apple II, but I mean, it's complicated because things like disk access and video access and stuff, you can't speed that up. You certainly can't speed up the disk access because, you know, it's waiting a certain number of cycles for the next thing to come around on the disk. And unless you also speed up the rotation of the disk, then, and you know, the sensors and all that stuff, then you need to slow back down to 1 megahertz when you're talking to the disks and talking to video and stuff like that. So it winds up being actually sort of complicated. You can't just turn the clock up. So, anyway, interesting project. Okay, let's see. Carrington, you have the next thing.
I do indeed. So it's not computer related, but it's related to the time in which I loved computers or began to first love them. Now, people, if you think of the 1970s, a lot of people think of like gaudiness in design. You've got like crazy things in disco and everything's gaudy. And one might forget that nobody did gaudy and intrusive like the 1980s, particularly through a design group called Memphis Design. It was actually an Italian thing. And it's one of the iconic looks of the 80s. So Memphis Design is crazy colors. I've got an example up on screen right now. Things that are asymmetrical, things that are bright and shiny, things that are all over the place, stripes and patterns and just like an explosion. Think Pee-wee's Playhouse. So there are lots of examples of this sort of thing through the 80s. And I have a soft spot for it, but I can't imagine living in a house of it. Could I? Maybe I could. But I could regardless, it's like so it's just, it's bright, it's vibrant, it's exciting. But one of the most iconic things, if people associate Memphis Design with, would be the Swatch. Swatch watch. Mm-hmm. We all remember the swatches and those crazy colors and stuff. That's one of the iconic things that came out of this design mentality. And Swatch has now re-released their 1984 most popular item. So if you miss the swatches and you want to program like it's 1984, you want to be in a cabin and make your remote programming, you can once again buy some of the iconic 1984 Swatch designs. There's the gray Memphis, which makes a lot of sense now that we know what the Memphis design is. There is the black Divers, which is a little staid, I think, if you're going to wear a Swatch. There's the white Memphis, which really starts to embrace the Memphis stuff. Mm-hmm. Then we get the Chronotech with the red band and multicolor. You got blue, yellow, and red arms. And then there's the yellow racer. So these are all now once again available. So if you think of Swatch as just something that you had in the 80s, that is no longer the case. If you feel that you need that extra bit of motivation when you're coding 1980s computers, perhaps when you look down at the keyboard, you non-touch typist you, and you see your wrist and you see that beautiful Swatch on there, you will feel extra motivated to actually get your version of Apple Writer done.
Yep. Exactly.
I'm excited about these things. If you're not going to wear a calculator watch, then you might as well want one of these things. I love it.
Well, you have two wrists.
Absolutely could be their slogan. You have two wrists.
I need this and a members only jacket.
Right?
Yeah.
So for cosplay, maybe. But just like, what the heck, man? If you're not going to wear like an Apple Watch or a fancy watch, you're going to wear just a fun one. Yeah, you could go boring and pretend to be James Bond or whatever and have a super expensive watch on your wrist. Who wants a super expensive watch? Do you never do anything that you bang your... I thump my wrist against stuff all the time. Uh-huh. Much rather have cheap watches. I love it. I love that they're bringing back the 1984 designs. It's just delightful. So,
yeah, that is pretty cool.
Yep.
End of the line, Joel, in the chat here had mentioned that Casio has also actually re-released their 1980s calculator watches.
Ah, so. Thing is, I don't think it's re-released. I believe Casio has been making those same watches steadily. We talked about it before. Uh-huh. Since that time, the watch that Marty McFly wears in Back to the Future, you can today buy, and I think you've been able to buy it steadily since that time. They just made so many of them. Mm-hmm. They're all still available, and they're very inexpensive. So yeah, you want a calculator watch, get the original calculator watches from Casio. They have a number of them available, but that one particular model, the Marty McFly model, that's the one I'd want. So hooray for retro watches. This just tickles me. Tickles my retro computer little heart that you can get actual Swatches from Swatch, not vintage ones, expensive on eBay, but just new, relatively inexpensive ones. Love it.
Yeah, one difference I think will be that the Swatches were worn by, you know, high school students and junior high students yes. back then. And now it's just going to be, it's going to be all retirees wearing Swatches.
Hey, the 80s is back. Kids like our style. They wear it, ironically or not. It's being worn. Right.
It's
I
true.
Always say, if you're wearing a trucker cap, ironically, whatever, you're still wearing a trucker cap. So you can wear a Swatch ironically. You're still wearing a Swatch. Welcome to the club.
Yeah.
And 80s is back. 80s is in. Right,
really, I think of Swatches, even though it's the 1984 collection, I personally think of Swatches as a late 80s thing going into early 90s. I think of it as a Parker Lewis Can't Lose synchronized Swatches kind of thing. I don't think of it as 1984. I think of it as 1989. So, but whatever. That's just me.
Yeah. You know, this that design also reminds me a lot of Memorex, I think, had a little line of both VHS and cassette tapes that had this kind of design on it. They were transparent, but they had this kind of like weird, abstract art going by mm-hmm. them. I wonder if I can find a picture of that.
Memphis design, the Memphis Milano, Memphis design stuff was so pervasive. It's easy to forget how much this informed so many things, including industrial design in the 80s. It started in 1980, really was only kind of Memphis group, I think, was only around till late 80s, 87, 88, something like that. But that in that 7 to 9 year period, they were incredibly effective in pushing design generally toward a certain thing. And that certain thing was just like, whoa, not subtle.
Yeah.
And then the 90s were like, we're sick of it. We're going grunge. None of us will ever wash again. Hey, look at that. Paul has brought up some tapes.
Do you not remember
those?
These
are right out of the Memphis group.
Yeah. And then there were these, you know, like pink and yellow and green Memorex tapes. I had a zillion of these. This looks so familiar. I still do. I probably could, you know, reach across and pick up a couple of them right now. but yeah, it is all the same the same sort of aesthetic. Yeah,
where you get these like triangles out of nowhere. Everything has to have just triangles on it. Triangles everywhere.
Excellent. Okay.
So let's watch this.
I had one other thing that I was going to mention. This is Tony Synthesis feedback. And it is, where is it? It is here. It is the historical source GitHub repository. It's interesting to sort of look through. It's basically, I think it's just basically a dumping ground for source code of all sorts. So I don't think it's any particular specific platform or language or anything like that. What's the pinned things are all Infocom things. But if you actually look at the almost 300 repositories, they're, you know, Star Wars, a space game, a food fighting game. and a lot of these things are just arcade things. So I just pulled up Pole Position and, you know, it's just a bunch of ROMs. There's a lot of these have a doc file that will sort of tell you like what these files are. You know, these are 2764 ROMs from Namco, November 12th, 1982. So I don't know what the source for all these things are, but I think this is basically just when people find source, they put them here. I think I've seen Jason Scott tweet about, you know, a couple of things as they went into here. So if you are looking for source code to explore, there is not a lot of help available here. You know, you have to figure out yourself what it is.
Crystal Castles,
a gem hunting game for bears. Anyway, so check that out if you're bored some lazy summer afternoon. See what's there. I think it's possible that you will find something interesting to read. Okay, let's see. I think with that we can move to a word from our sponsor.
You're looking at a small portable computer called the IBM 5100. It's helping a lot of different people do their work more productively.
Managing real estate investments entails many difficult decisions. Do I pay it now or later? What about the landscaping? Can we afford it? What about taxes? There are many, many difficult decisions to make. It's really nice having a computer to help.
It weighs about 50 pounds. You can plug it in anywhere.
Bad weather, late deliveries, construction delays of all kinds.
How is it going to affect our schedule?
Now we can find that out fast.
The 5100 can help handle some very complex information.
Jet fuel is expensive. At Simmons Precision, we're developing a product that'll help the pilots save fuel. Flight test time is also expensive. But we do our flight tests right here in the lab on our 5100 and save time and money.
Capacity? About the same as some large computers a few years ago.
We're a mid-sized life insurance company. If we want to compete, and we do, we've got to be flexible. We've got to get answers fast. This little machine will help us do it.
The 5100 is easy to learn and simple to use.
There are countless combinations of feed we can mix. What is the most economical for any particular herd? That's what I'm figuring out now.
The cost of the 5100 is reasonable.
Paper, ink, size, weight, overhead, and don't forget the shipping cost. Estimating a printing job is not so easy. Our estimators handle 50% more work since we got the 5100.
We do it faster and a lot more accurately, and our customers really love it.
The IBM 5100. It's bringing the advantages of the computer to more and more people. IBM, helping put information to work for people.
And we're back. So
that was a great sponsor ad.
Oh, yes, it was. Yes, fantastic.
Fantastic.
Actually, I think we know it was IBM. So go IBM.
Do we? Okay. I don't think I know that at this time.
It's for the 5100. Mm-hmm. Get one while you can.
So the host's retro computing gift idea this time is on the board game theme. It is a board game called Lovelace and Babbage. Carrington, you were the one who found this. I don't know if you know much about it.
Well, yes. Well done, me. I don't know anything about this.
That's $20. What do you have to lose?
Exactly. Well, $20.
Yeah. And there's a YouTube video that explains how to play Lovelace and Babbage, but it's so it says in Lovelace and Babbage, players program the world's first computer, the analytical engine, to help famous patrons solve challenging problems. Compete against your fellow programmers in real time. develop your subroutines, and upgrade the shared computer. Receive influence from patrons in 5 areas of society, balance, speed, care, and clever maneuvers to win. So
I love how many games have been made where the goal is to program something. Mm-hmm. As if anybody but us want that game. It is crazy that that's a thing. There's so many of these. Like, this is a game about programming in C. This is a game about programming in Fortran. This is a, no, how would I ever convince anybody in my life to play these games with me? Even on my birthday, even one time.
Yep.
Not a chance. And who wants to be Babbage when you can be Lovelace? Everyone's going to fight over the one person.
I think my family would play this, you know, with me once.
It's pretty looking. Like, it's got a real cyberpunk feel. So maybe you could fool people into thinking it's something different. And then they're trapped. Then they're playing the game, and it's, like, rude to stop.
Yeah.
And even if the game isn't great, which we don't know. I mean, it may be fantastic.
Oh, we know.
But
it's a programming game.
I'm obsessed with these things. I'm obsessed with picking up a bunch of programming games. I want to get a bunch and bring them to Kansas Fest, because, like, the only people in my life that I will ever get to play any of these programming games, and I would like to play them all, is people at Kansas Fest. Mm-hmm. I suspect if I bring these games there, people will play these games with me, and then I will leave these games there because they will have fulfilled their function in my life.
It could be a whole evening session.
Could be. How exciting. How exciting for me. I'd play all of them.
I think I'm not entirely convinced this isn't fun. This might actually
See,
be.
That's how they get you.
Yeah.
I mean, I love games. I love board games. I love tabletop games. I love gaming of all sort. And so the idea that a game would also relate to other things I love, like computer programming, sounds wonderful to me. But, bingo cards ready, my girlfriend, lives in Canada, you wouldn't know her, would never play this thing with me. And I get her to play tons of tabletop games. I think she would find this boring.
Yeah.
I think so.
Well, with that sales pitch.
with that glowing endorsement.
You can get the... So we found it at least at Genius Games. I'm not sure if this may be their own thing or this may be just a seller of games, but we found it. It looks like the company's name is Artana, and it is $19.99 from
$20 for a tabletop game is very reasonable.
Yeah, and it does look nice. So even if you don't play it, it might look nice displayed on a shelf.
Is that one of those sunk cost things? Like you have a game that you don't play, just to have it.
Oh, that might. Come up later in the YouTube as well.
Okay.
And when I say YouTube, I mean eBay. But, you know, it's one of those big internet corporations.
They're all the same. Big faceless corporations who hate us.
So once you have exhausted all of the people in your life that will play Lovelace and Babbage with you, we can turn to eBay. And Carrington has the first of the things to look at on eBay.
I do indeed. Now, if you're going to sit down for a long time and play a game, I think I'm sharing it on the screen here. One thing that you might want to do is save your butt with a stadium seat cushion. And this, especially for the starting bid of $10, if you pick up $10, it's pretty cheap. It's an Apple NFL Super Bowl seat cushion. So it's got the Apple logo on one side and Super Bowl XIX, Super Bowl 19 on the other side. And you won't have to scurry off to Google to figure out, is that the Super Bowl in which Apple played its great, big, famous commercial or not, because I did that for you. And the answer is no, it is not. It's the next year. It would be so much better if this was Super Bowl XVIII. What is with you people having, like, come on. What, you people, by which I mean Americans, all of you listeners, why is your Super Bowl always in Roman numerals? It makes it so difficult to understand. And why isn't it just the year? Why isn't it just Super Bowl 1985? So this is the Super Bowl from 1985. Disappointingly, not the Super Bowl from 1984. But let's say you went to the 1984 Super Bowl. You were so impressed by the commercial that you just stayed there. Wait, there are different different stadiums every year, aren't they? Don't know football. So then they pick you up and they carry you the next year to the next stadium. And you're waiting and waiting for Apple's big commercial. But there isn't one. But to mop up your salty tears, they give you this. I don't know. It struck me as an interesting thing. So if you're into sports and you're going to watch something, you could sit on an Apple Super Bowl seat cushion. And for $10, I think that's a good deal for an Apple collectible. This, who knows? If there's 6 days left, it might go up to $200, in which case it's not even remotely a good deal. Why are you paying so much money for a seat cushion? but for $10, sure, why not? Mm-hmm. This is my first choice. Paul, have I convinced you to buy this?
I mean, it's an interesting artifact, and it's sort of known. It's known that they did this, you know, so it is kind of neat to be able to say, like, they had a Super Bowl cushion 1 year, and this is it.
Wait, did you? This was the thing you knew? You knew they did Super Bowl cushions?
Oh, I think it's one of the sort of known collectibles out there.
I did not know this.
Oh. But
well, and if you're trying to get the complete set, you need to be careful because the eBay title looks like it might be incorrect. It says it's the Super Bowl XX seat cushion. Mm-hmm. But
ooh, maybe that's why it's going to be cheap.
It's the XIX seat cushion. Imagine your disappointment.
When you wanted one from the next year. And also, it would be hard to get the whole set because there's probably like 30, 40,000 people in the stadium. So to actually collect the entire set of these would be expensive.
Yeah, I think that probably would be.
I'm trying to get one, all of them, all 30,000 seat cushions.
Some of them may not actually be in a condition that you want as well.
Yes, this may not be. Anyway, that's my first choice. My second choice, keeping in with the theme of the last thing I was talking about, synchronized swatches, folks. If you want a bit more Memphis design, it's a computer mouse mat from the UK, £6. It's your lovely Memphis design computer mouse pad. I like this because Memphis design, it's weirdly making a comeback, but it's essentially a dead design language. Mouse pads, yeah, they're useful. Yeah. So this is like hitting with all cylinders on usefulness, and I love it. I absolutely love it. So it's from the UK, $6. Get yourself a Memphis design mouse pad, and then look down. Have your Memphis design on your mouse on the one hand, your swatch on the other hand, and you're just living the life. You're making all good decisions.
Mm-hmm. Listening to your cassette tape. Very nice. End of the line, Joel, in the chat mentioned that I think it's possible I'd heard this before, but the 1984 commercial that Apple made actually did run late at night on some channel somewhere in 1983 in order to qualify for the end of the year awards. So it was sort of previewed in secret somewhere, but it had to air in order to qualify. So
sneaky.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. Earl, you have the next thing.
What do you have that could possibly beat a Memphis design mouse pad?
I'm sure you will be convinced that this is in fact that thing.
Okay. It'd be hard to imagine I wouldn't be. What do you got?
Can you display it?
I will. Yes, I will try to
for the for our tubers.
We have potatoes?
Little taters, we call them.
So, normally, I don't like to see things broken out and, sold piecemeal. But this is an exception, and I'll tell you why. What we're looking at is an auction for an Atari 400 keyboard. And you'll recall that the Atari 400 membrane keyboard was famously awful to type on. And what would happen is, back in the day, there were some aftermarket replacements that would give you more of a full-touch keyboard. I don't know that this is what's happened here, but I suspect that somebody took this Atari membrane keyboard out and replaced it with one of the upgrades, and now the original keyboard is being sold, which is cool for a couple of reasons. One is, I just love the design of this keyboard. I would buy
too.
It. Just to look at it.
This is an example of one of those things that is not useful, but beautiful. Like, it's just, I love the colors. I love the look. It's horrendous as a typing thing, but it's the reason why I think the Atari 400 looks better than the Atari 800. Although the Atari 800 is better than the Atari 400. It definitively is, underscore is. But this just looks so futuristic. I just love the colors. I love the browns. I love it. It's one of my favorite looking keyboards, but I never want to touch it.
Mm-hmm. It actually does look a little bit like the Star Trek, the Star Trek screens. It has that same kind of that same kind of design.
Well spotted.
Well, the other thing is the auction is starting at a bid of $499, which I thought was cool. Mm-hmm. And lastly, with some Atari 400 keyboards, they weren't treated as well as others, either in terms of the environment in which they were stored or the way in which they were used. Some of them started to crack. Some of them were badly faded. This actually looks pretty good. It says lightly used, and when I went through the auction pictures, it looked like it was in pretty good shape. And so if you have an Atari 400 keyboard, now they don't, they say they don't know for sure if it works. So that's one thing to be careful.
That's
about.
One thing about this keyboard. It's almost impossible to know if it works.
That's right.
Even if it is working.
If you're typing, it's wait, is this working? Is this working as expected?
So, but if you have an Atari 400 and the keyboard is battered and bruised, like some of them became over time.
Angrily beat upon.
Exactly. This might be a worthwhile replacement for
especially
you.
For $5. Like if it stays relatively cheap, who knows? But
to me, $5 and $8 shipping, I'm almost tempted to get it myself. I don't think I will, but
yeah,
very reasonable.
Well, no bidders yet, so we'll see.
Yeah, those do look really nice. Okay, let's see. So I have, of course, I have a few, but I'll keep it
cool,
a little,
what you got?
A little low. Let's see. So I kind of went down a weird non-computing rabbit hole when I saw this.
What is
this? And I think it was listed. I don't know why I saw it. I guess it was. I guess maybe it was mislisted in a computing technology category or whatever. But it says vintage Thomas Edison Ediphone voice writer, dictaphone wax cylinder recorder, and that's more or less what it is. It is a wax cylinder dictaphone dictation machine.
All my future podcast episodes will come out on wax cylinders. I love this.
It's
wow,
and they will be sent to you by pneumatic tube. Funk,
funk, funk. Yes, I hope so. But yeah, so basically it's just a little thing. It has a metal spindle that the wax cylinder goes on, and there's a connection. This is supposed to have a like a speaking tube, which is not included. And actually, no wax cylinders are included with this particular auction, but it's a $40 starting bid. So it's actually not very expensive for this sort of thing. I found there are some, you can find some dictaphone wax cylinders separately in a separate auction. So they look like, you know, they look kind of like little wax black cylinders. I think if you could kind of zoom in on the photos, you can see that they have a kind of a, like record type, you know, grooving on them. So so you could conceivably play them. And I found a video of, let's see, somebody who found one of these at a thrift store and sort of walked through like how it works, like how you use the thing, had some sort of solutions for the missing tube. He got some like funnels and stuff from Walmart and connected it to the thing.
Well, you know how like with certain magnetic media, you can microwave it or whatever to erase it. Mm-hmm. I wonder if with wax cylinders, you just got to heat them up and it just smooths it out. And there you have effectively erased it. Time to start again.
Well, there was some kind of oil that this guy in the video used. The video's by CJ Holmes. That sort of like rubbed it down to erase the stuff that was on it before, because it was, you know, meeting notes or something that wasn't precious.
My friends and I make puzzles for each other, escape rooms, scavenger hunts. Mm-hmm. I'm working on a scavenger hunt right now for my girlfriend. You've already checked out that bingo box, so it doesn't count. Mm-hmm. Mentioning her. I love the idea of sending the first clue on a wax cylinder and just like deal with it, figure out how to play it. It's like we're now raised everything to another level. Because if you receive just a wax cylinder, how would you go about listening to its contents? Like, could you go to a library? Like, where would I figure out a way to play it? That seems like a fun little extra twist puzzle to throw in. My gal might regret your auction choice.
Yeah. it's actually kind of neat to see, like, you know, they... So the guy in the video recorded some stuff, and then, you know, went to try to play it and had to sort of seek around a little bit, you know, manually to try to find it. When you actually were using this, the wax cylinders came with a little insert that went into a little thing that's, you know, it's a little sliding thing below the cylinder itself. And there's a couple little punch buttons that let you punch, like, you know, here's the beginning and here's the end of the recording, you know, physically, linearly on the medium. And there are two punch buttons. One of them is labeled C, I think, which was to indicate a correction. Like, so if there's a correction that you needed to do, then you sort of notated it. It's sort of like, you know, edit points in a podcast, right?
Mm. That was probably also useful if you only use part of a cylinder, because no doubt you'd want to use the rest. He's not got a message here, but it ends at this point. I can safely record past that.
Yeah.
Love it. Love everything about this. This is truly a lovely item.
Yeah. So it's not, and I mean, the one in the video is lovelier than the one on eBay, but the one on eBay is not bad, and it really doesn't seem to cost very much. So
yeah, what is it, like a $40? Yeah, yeah. $40 starting bid. I would take something like this for $40.
Yeah.
I think I would easily get $40 worth of fun out of this.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. Anyway, so I thought it was interesting. It's not retro computing related, but, you know, whatever. Not everything is.
Does it say what year approximately these are from? What time frame?
20s, I think.
Oh, but how about, okay, what about a retro challenge in November? You get one of these things, record software to it, and see if you can read it back into your computer through the audio jack.
Yeah, I was thinking,
like, distribute software this way.
It would be an interesting thing to see if you could record something like cassette software onto this. The frequency response of these is terrible.
Right.
But it's possible you could do it.
But a lot of software on cassette I was never able to get to load either. Right. So it might be a legitimate recreation of the experience.
Yeah, exactly. It would work equally well.
Yeah.
Just like your Atari 400 keyboard. Okay, let's see. What else did I find? I thought this was sort of interesting. This is just sort of a note. Yeah, I mean, like, I'm not suggesting bidding on this. This is Online Systems, Sierra, is what they became known as. An adventure game for the Apple II called Mystery House. And it actually still has a fair amount of its plastic wrapper around it. It's been opened, so the contents have been taken out, but it's been carefully opened. It's called High Res Adventure Number 1, Mystery House. It is a notably collectible game.
I didn't know there was an online version of it. I only know it as the Sierra, the black Sierra version.
Well, it's basically the first, I think it might be the first graphic adventure game, something like that. So it has 7 days, almost 8 days to go, 7 days, 23 hours. It has 22 bids. It is currently at $1,684, which is kind of crazy. Because when you look at it, it is, you know, it's a piece of cardboard. It's a little registration card. It's a disc that may or may not work, and it's, you know, a piece of paper.
But again, this is like, it's collectible because of its history, because
exactly.
of what it is,
yeah.
Not so much for the use of it.
Yeah, so I was thinking a little bit about, you know, the idea of, you know, getting something that you actually aren't going to play. I mean, like, the point of having this is not to play it. The point of having this is that this is an artifact. You know, so, but I'm still pretty amazed at how fast that went up so high.
With 7 days left to go, too.
Yeah.
So there's going to be some big bidders just holding off till near the end. So this is going to go for a lot.
Yeah. Anyway, sort of interesting.
Good luck with your bidding, Paul.
Yeah, I have one.
Do you really?
but seeing this, I do kind of wonder how long I will have one.
Right?
Yeah, anyway. But it's pretty amazing. There are people who value the history of this to that extent. I mean, and it's in good shape. I mean, and it has the plastic. And I mean, like, that's, you know, that's interesting. But when you really do sort of think about the raw materials when they made the thing, I mean, it was just, you know, they got some nice art. They printed it, you know, mass produced it on a small scale on a piece of paper. And that's what it is. So I found a auction for something called the Laser 50. I'm not sure if we've ever talked about this before, and I don't know too much about it, but it's basically kind of like a little learning computer.
So it's not laser like the Laser 500? Is it same laser computer? Like,
I think it
company?
Is. I think it is.
Cool.
They made a bunch of stuff. So they did, you know, they did make like Apple II compatibles, but I think this is a much more basic in every sense computer. You know, so it's got a single line display. It's got
what more do you need?
Right. I saw this. I thought it was sort of interesting. One of the things that I thought was interesting was on the back they talk about the expansion options. You know, so you can get a cassette and a printer, a couple different printers actually, and a couple things that I can't even read. You know, but there's a couple more things that you can add to it. Looks like maybe a I don't even know.
The last two are so small. They must be just cartridges or something, because it was smaller than a tape player. So I'm gonna got RAM and ROM packs probably.
Yeah, but it would be, you know. So I was thinking, you know, these are probably largely, you know, thrown away by now. So the fact that there are actually two on eBay is a little bit surprising.
Are they really? Oh. I suspect I would like to play with one of these. Yeah. I don't know that I actually want to invest and own one, but to sit down and write a little basic program for this would probably be a fun thing.
Yeah. And both of these, actually, that I found, the one was $75, one was $120. So it's not, you know, they're at fairly high asking prices, but they're both pretty complete. So they have the manuals, the boxes in nice shape. So you could get that experience, and you know, it's possible that you would get $75 worth of entertainment out of it anyway. But I was also thinking too that just like, I wonder if you will ever, ever be able to find those expansion things. And I bet the answer is, of course you won't. So
also, where did they even get produced? Just because they're on the box?
It's always a good question, yeah.
Right.
Great question.
A similar computer to this was the, this looks like it has a real keyboard, but the TI-CC40.
Yeah.
Was similar, single line display, basic programmable, and some of the options for the CC40 either didn't get produced or in insufficient numbers so as to make them unobtainable at this point. Is this VTech?
Yeah.
Is that what it said in the... Okay. So it is the same VTech that made the other laser. Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah. The CC40, I'm trying to remember. I think the thing that was that they never... really made for it was the storage device. So you can't get anything out of it, which is like just kind of insane. And I think there's a serial port or something, but I don't think there isn't any sort of like either cassette or tape or like disk drive. I don't think for that.
You have pen and paper. Stop being so lazy.
That's right.
Write it all out.
Okay. Let's see. And then I guess the last thing, this wasn't super, super vintage. It was actually 2003, I think. Yeah, it says. But I thought it was kind of interesting. It's the space ball. It is a mouse that is in kind of a pleasing configuration. It's just sort of a ball that's kind of floating in space. I mean, it's not quite.
If Memphis Design made a mouse.
Yeah.
It's this.
That's also a good name. The Space Ball 2003C. But
the sequel to the original movie.
Apparently, it's, you know, you can get the drivers for it. That's been tested by the seller to a certain extent.
Okay, so it's like for CAD stuff or 3D things. Yeah. Got it. Cool.
Anyway, it's sort of a unique thing that I hadn't seen before. We might have to start accepting the possibility that 2003 counts as retro.
Everything's retro. Wednesday's retro.
That's right.
If your memory's bad enough, everything's retro.
That's right. Oh, and I guess, yeah, okay, I'll talk about this last one and then I'll quit. But this I thought it was interesting. We've talked a little bit about the Coleco Atom and how the fact is that the power supply was in the printer. And that's kind of annoying because who wants a printer? This is a Coleco Atom power supply that seems to be actually badged as a Coleco Atom. You can't really see it.
I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah, I also did not. And I don't know. I still don't know if it's a thing. You know, it is at least made to look like it was badged by Coleco. And I think the seller believes it is old. It's conceivable that it really is old and Coleco sold this thing. But if they did, this is an instance of it. If they didn't, this is a nice mock-up of what it would have looked like had they sold it.
Yep.
And regardless, it's useful to the extent that you want to use an Atom and don't want to have a printer.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of caveats there, but...
But it's useful to that extent, yeah.
Right. So
are a lot of things.
So I think we made it through pretty well. Pretty well.
We did indeed. Well done, us.
Okay, let's see. So I guess we can move on to closing discussions already. Carrington, do you have any closing notes?
In the retro world, I read a book this week that was different than most retro computer books. I read all the retro computer books. I like them. I like reading history of computer stuff and like this person made this language or this programming thing or whatever. Last week I read Soul of a New Machine. Do you guys know that one? Yeah, and I quite enjoyed it. I think maybe I read it a couple weeks ago. I read it before the last time I was on the podcast. Mm. But it didn't even seem worth bringing up. It was good. It was, you know, creating a computer thing, and it was fun. About the Data General, I don't know, one of their mini computers, and it was an interesting look at like the creation of a mini computer. But it was kind of the same as all those books. If you like the books, it's as good as any. But this week I read one that was finally different. It was like the first time I've read a computer book that said, all that is myth. Every time you read about this kind of stuff, it's all lies. Here's how computing happened. And it's called A People's History of Computing in the United States. And I was not persuaded by it, but I kind of wanted to be. So it was a really, what a fascinating read. So it's about the invention of the personal computer. And it starts with this idea that we're given this myth that computing was giant monolith mainframes, and then a few white dudes gave us networking and computing and brought computing to the people. And thank goodness for these half a dozen white dudes. Like, it's just like you got Gates and Allen and Wozniak and then the modern people, the dude bros who are running everything. It's like, and this book says like, that's not at all what happened. And starts to talk about the difference between, say, batch processing and timeshare. And those are fundamentally different things and ways to approach computing. And timeshare had fundamentally networking in it. And it was about a ton of people doing stuff together back then, like back before the Apple. You have people like the general public just getting into computers and networking things and having things that were essentially, you know, addressed message passing, which was essentially email and online games and all those things, through these other texts that were more generally available. Where it falls down is its example of generally available will be like the time sharing system at Dartmouth and how all these people at Dartmouth used it. And I always step back and go, well, Dartmouth is also not exactly indicative of the general population of the United States, even if it's everybody at Dartmouth, which it wasn't. It was only like math majors at Dartmouth. But it was just fun. It was fun to read a book that was just taking a different stance, a different idea that like there's other things that happened in computing. And it takes a real like adversarial stance. It's like the author was Lisi Rankin. Don't know who this person is. I don't even know why I picked up the book, but it's a real, you know, like power to the people. This is what really happened. That's all a myth. So if you want to read something different, like a different approach to computer history, I'd recommend it. It was a fun, not necessarily persuasive, but interesting book. So happy to have read it. It's the first different thing in computer history I've read in ages. So I did that.
Excellent.
Have either of you guys read it or heard of it? I'd never heard of it before.
No. Oh. But yeah, I'm curious now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely worth the read. It's like most of these things. It's a quick book. It's probably 300 pages or something, but you fly through it. It's, you know, easy single evening read. I liked it, but it's interesting that it takes this kind of anti Silicon Valley approach. It says, oh no. There were a lot more people involved. Let me show you an example of other white guys, but it's not quite persuasive, but it's really fascinating. It's very different than any other book I've read on the subject. So definitely worth the read. Yeah, highly, highly recommend it. Let's see if anybody else is more persuaded than I was. But I wanted to be. I was on for. I'm like, come on, no, give me more. Oh well, nope. But still, I liked it. That was fun. Yeah. Cool. I've done that.
Earl, you have further shameless plugs you'd like to put in?
Yes. Well, it's an extension of the shameless plug from before that Randy and I kicked out. We kicked out a new episode of Next Without Four. And it's about the language Snowball, all in caps. And you might think, wow, that must be related to COBOL, which is suspiciously also all in caps and has an O-ball on the end. But
it does indeed have an O-ball on the end.
But they couldn't be more different languages. And the reason that Snowball had stuck with me from the university class that I took which was a survey of programming languages. So we spent about 2 weeks on each one and just kind of blazed through a bunch of them just to see how different languages did different things. And the thing that I loved about Snowball was it dealt with character strings really well. That's kind of its whole reason for living. Character string parsing, string manipulation, that kind of thing. Whenever I would look at a new version of BASIC back in the day, one of the things I wanted to know was, what string parsing functions does it have built in? Because that's really helpful and really important stuff. So, but taking the deep dive into Snowball was fascinating. And probably the most fascinating part was the regular expression stuff that we know from modern languages. You know, all modern languages have some library or capability to deal with character strings really well. And you had the Unix functions and Perl and stuff like that. But this goes way back. And it was so incredibly functional. There were so many different ways in which you could slice and dice a character string. I was surprised. I was surprised, actually, to see something in the 60s that had this much of that capability. So anyway, we could have a link over to that episode. Again, shameless plug, but I really enjoyed that. That was so much fun, and it was really fun reliving something from my university days. Now, in those days, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have a lot of resources. I think the only thing I had was just the book for the class that breezed over the basics of Snowball. So you couldn't really do a deep dive, and obviously I didn't have a computer at home to go play with Snowball. It didn't even ever really run on 8-bit computers. So having the internet now and all the PDFs and the capability to run a modern interpreter for it was fun too. I was able to learn more than I ever could have learned back then. So,
cool.
It was fun.
Did we determine last time that the N in Snowball is the N in string?
Oh, see, you have to listen to the podcast because okay. We actually talk about the naming, and it's a fun story, and I'm not going to give it away.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, no, it's I really like the fact that that podcast exists. Actually, it's a really sort of interesting niche. Yep. So. Looking forward
it was
to
way
listening
too
to
long
it.
Between episodes. We've got our topic pick for the next one.
It dives into like languages, right? So like, I think it's the kind of thing where it's perfectly like I'm a subscriber and I love what you guys are doing. And if it's months between episodes, that's okay. It's not a current events podcast. It comes out and it'd be like, here's a fun thing about this language. Like whatever, take as much time as you want. It's you're making a record of like just talking about these things. So I think it's totally fine. Some podcasts, yes, I want it to be a regular thing. This one is just one that it's great when an episode comes out and I listen to it. It's awesome. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sort of like a surprise gift too. When you forget that you're on the feed and then suddenly, oh, here's a new one of these. Excellent. Let's see. For me, I'm still setting stuff up. Spent a lot of time sort of scanning things. Largely kind of like figuring out my scanning pipeline. And I think it's working pretty well.
Wait, are you doing a different scanning pipeline now that you're in a new location?
Yeah. Well, right. And it's partly worse in a way because it's a I have a flatbed scanner of the home variety rather than a industrial photocopier of the office variety.
Got it.
So it's a much slower process. But Michael had suggested, I think, I don't know when, maybe it wasn't even on our podcast. It might have been on Retro Maccast. I'm not sure. But he suggested using ScanTailor Advanced, which is it's a program that basically sort of lets you sort of adjust like the skew. It does a lot of automatic page separation and stuff like that. And I was sort of skeptical. It seemed like it was kind of slow. Didn't work as well as I wanted it to until I figured out how to use it. And it's still maybe a little bit slow, but I've actually come entirely around. That is great. It is much better than what I was able to do with Acrobat. So yes, I would recommend attempting to use ScanTailor Advanced if you want to try to do this kind of scanning stuff. I think it works pretty well. But so eventually, the next step is going to be upload all the stuff. But right. I'm at least doing some of the scanning. And this is a project it's a long-term project, but I kind of wanted to at least work out the steps that I was going to have to go through. So these are sort of like test projects. One of them was, in fact, the things I've been scanning have been these. See, actually, I think I can find them. They're these special delivery software, you know, Apple things. Mm. So Apple had this distributed a bunch of software early on. And basically, they just served as distributors for other people. So in order to increase the sort of distribution, the amount of software that was available for the platform, they sort of distributed some third-party things. And so I'd been scanning some of those. And the reason I've mentioned it is Apple Writer 2 and Music Comp were both Paul Lutus things that were in that series. But anyway, I've been sort of scanning through those, and I think I may actually get rid of them at the end once I've finished, you know, digitally archiving them. But that's been an interesting project. So I will keep doing that.
Very cool, though, you preserving those things.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was supposed to be the point. That's why I have to have all this junk, right? But I sort of had gotten a little caught up in the accumulation and less in the actual preservation part. So then I guess that is it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the shows in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. And you can write a review on iTunes. That will help people find the show, we think. And until next time,
Retro Compute!